Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on Kaechung Radio, Chinatown's only microbroadcasting radio station. I'm Nicholas Miller, here live in the flesh with none other than Stephen Cato.
Hello, I'm Steve Cato. I have not yet won the COVID lottery.
True. I mean, even though we tossed our names in the hat too many times, all we got were these silly $50 Visa cards. Mine didn't even have $50 on it. How about yours, Steve?
I was just double checking my voicemail just now. Sorry. I was just seeing if maybe the Department of Health had called to tell me that I'd won.
Oh, yeah.
But no, there was just a mysterious voicemail that said that they were calling to renew my warranty.
I heard that they've enlisted, you know, because of the quote labor shortage, they've had to enlist mockingbirds to deliver the announcements.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So he's been trying to deliver it this whole time.
Have you been ignoring any mockingbirds in your...
Yeah, there's a mockingbird harassing everyone in my yard, and it's just trying to give me $50,000.
Yeah, or you could go to college for free.
Yeah, shit.
Yeah.
Well, what do I do? Do I let it in? How does it work?
I only read the Reddit headlines these days. I don't actually, I don't click through to the whole media article. Too often I've been disappointed by the whole thing.
I noticed that due to the labor shortage, Gavin Newsom himself draws the lotto numbers out of a rolling ball.
That was from the labor shortage?
Yeah, is it not due to the labor shortages? Is that not why?
I don't know.
But that did happen. That is going on.
Yeah, no, I did see that. I hadn't connected it with this horrible labor shortage, but
no, but it's because the Vanna Whites of the world are unavailable because they're not showing up to work.
Yeah. Is there
the people who normally do this? The professionals aren't turning up to work.
Yeah, yeah, those lazy bums.
He does have great hair. You know, he has a lot of the qualifications of someone who does that job normally.
Right.
But in you know,
chiseled jawline.
Yeah.
I think he's got a bright future. Retirement at the retirement home. You know.
Ooh, yeah, or just even going into showbiz when he's no longer governor.
Yeah, that'll be a first,
game show.
Right?
Pat Sajak's not going to live forever, right?
Well, won't that be the first? Because I feel like in California, oftentimes you go into showbiz to get into politics, but someone should do it the other way around.
Wasn't Jerry Springer like the mayor of Cincinnati or something?
Was that from a different labor shortage?
Well, no, that was before he was a talk show host.
No, I know. There just weren't enough people who wanted to be mayor.
Oh, right.
Oh, goodness.
You know, what was funny was, one of my pleasures every morning is listening to Democracy Now. And it's always nice when there's content about the Young Lords, the Puerto Rican sort of self-defense group in the, you know, sort of modeled on the Black Panthers in the 60s and 70s. That co-host of Democracy Now, Juan Gonzalez, was a member of.
Right.
And so there was some Young Lords content on today, which always thrilling. And, you know, and there's the sound of young Juan, you know, haranguing crowds and giving great speeches. And you're just like, wow, Juan, so cool. But what's crazy about the Young Lords is that, like, the other... Most of them have gone on to be labor organizers or journalists, or some of them are dead. But one of the early members is Geraldo Rivera.
Oh, really? He was Young Lord?
Yeah. And it's amazing to think that, you know, back in the day, Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now and Geraldo Rivera were, like, you know, occupying a hospital together, you know, harangue, you know, Mayor Lindsay in New York for, you know, proper medical care for the Puerto Rican community. You know what I mean? Like, and then to sort of turn around and have, like, Geraldo Rivera become Geraldo Rivera, you know, I just wonder what happens if they meet up every now and again, or if like they go to the reunions or something, you know, and everyone's like, you know, like whether they call each other on Christmas or something, you know?
Yeah.
I just wonder what the deal is.
I mean, geez, who, I never would have thought that those two were in, were part of, right? Both in the Young Lords.
Right. I mean, like Juan Gonzalez, I think everyone pretty much knows that he was in the, you know, makes a big deal of it. Kind of, you hear about it often.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
like people who went to Lords. Yale or something.
Yeah. Or I mean, you know, frequent listeners to Democracy Now, every now and again, there's some Young Lord content that comes on and everyone's like, and you know, we've got founder of the Young Lords, Juan Gonzalez here. On the, he's just like, oh, ho, 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 ho. You know, yeah, I mean, whatever, I'd gloat too. It's fine. I'm charmed by that content. I have nothing but time in my life to have Juan Gonzalez, marinate in the glory of being a Young Lord. I think that's just fantastic.
I feel like the dirtbag left should resurrect Celebrity Deathmatch, and that would be a good pairing for sure.
Oh yeah,
the claymation battle between those two.
This is the kind of ritual behavior, right, that I think I mean, we use professional sports for this kind of thing, I guess, mostly, right? But it's the kind of sort of structurally defined, symbolic, cultural behavior that, you know, so it's like the opposite, that calls for sort of the implosion of opposites into each other, right? The dialectical hurling of Geraldo Rivera into Juan Gonzalez and vice versa, mm-hmm. Right?
But they both break from the violence to cover the horrible labor conditions of the claymation workers whose art form has been systematically denigrated over the years, where this is the only venue left is working for MTV's Celebrity Deathmatch. There's just no other gigs. There are no other gigs.
I mean, yeah, Art Clokey had to close down the Gumby world, right? That the heirs to the Clokey fortune. Previously, the most stable source of claymation revenue in the claymation world.
They closed it because of the novel coronavirus pandemic?
I think lack of interest in Gumby.
Oh, yeah.
Which is unfortunate, because, I mean, like, if you look at the intellectual property that's thriving, you can't in any way claim that it's better or more creative than Gumby.
And I feel like Gumby would do great on TikTok or something, right?
Right, yeah, it's kinetic, it's super psychedelic.
Yeah, elastic.
It's great when you're high.
Yeah, I mean, could really express himself with great brevity.
It's true, like, as a physical entity, Gumby is maybe the most, it's amazing that made it out. You know what I mean? That, like, when I was a kid, you could just go buy Gumbies at the store.
Yeah, I had several Gumbies.
You know, it's because it's so weird. Like, actually watching the show is terrifyingly strange.
Most cartoons are, as an adult.
Really?
I feel like Gumby and Odo should make a comeback.
Ooh.
Together.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, two great tastes that go great together.
Well, speaking of Odo, and distant civilizations and peoples, we have some very special guests on the show tonight who've traveled here through space time to be with us at the Kaechung Studios and explore difficult concepts like anthropology and the Prime Directive. We have here with us the venerable Claude Lévi-Strauss, his plus one, and artist Ron Hamilton.
Hello. Claude Lévi-Strauss is a world-famous anthropologist. His studies of the structure of human societies and of the structure of the human mind are far-reaching.
Everything, well, even from South America, leads toward here, and everything goes away from here.
Lévi-Strauss's demonstrations are based to a large extent on American Indian materials. And within these cultures, he has discovered a special significance in the myths of the Northwest Pacific coast.
Oh yes, because you see, the ecology is so important for me, and I think it plays such a part in the myth that, well, there are a lot of things which should be not only seen, but lived in, if I may say so, to understand them right.
Lévi-Strauss did fieldwork in Brazil in the 30s. Later, he devoted himself mainly to the analysis of anthropological data in his study in Paris. In 1973, he came to British Columbia to continue his research, focusing on the relationship between myths and the visual arts.
In the old mask and the old poles, Sonokoa is always blind. That is, she has either deep-set eyes or else eyes half-closed. And in the more recent poles, I'm struck by the fact that the eyes are perfectly normal. So what I wondered, if it was on purpose, and what was the reason for the change?
Well, I have no idea at all.
Yeah.
No idea at all. No idea at all.
But if you were to carve it, Zonokoa, how would you do it?
I would do it either of the two ways.
With deep-set eyes?
I would do it with deep-set eyes. We have, see, I'm not from the Kwajalein country.
Yes,
I'm from the west coast
problem,
of Vancouver,
yes,
Island. But where we come from, we have wild woman too.
Yes.
And when I carve her, where is it? Right here. I carve her with the eyes open too.
You carve it with the eye open.
But small eyes.
Yes. That's another way of expressing the blindness or that she has trouble in seeing.
I made a mask for Peter, wild woman, and the eyes are real deep set, way back.
Uh-huh.
But the reason for making it like that wasn't to try and make her look blind. It was just to make her brow, pronounce her brow.
Uh-huh.
If you bring the brow out, the eyes automatically go back.
Yes, of course.
And to make her look strong, you give her deep, heavy eyebrow.
Uh-huh.
It's the same with the cheekbones. Bringing the cheekbones out like that.
Uh-huh. But in the old mythology, it is always explained that she's blind or she has trouble seeing or that she's half asleep also.
Half asleep?
Half asleep, yes.
We got stories at home. I never heard a story of her being blind, never.
Uh-huh.
But we got lots of stories
the
about she's half asleep. She's easy to trick.
Yes.
This the guy that killed her, where I'm from, she's, I guess, been half asleep. She's not too smart. He tricks her lots of times.
Yes.
He gets her fingers caught in a stump. He was splitting a stump.
Yes, I know this.
And
yes.
Got her hand. Well, she's kind of, I don't know if the right word is, dozy, or she's sleepy, not too smart.
Well, yes, dozy, and when she appears in dances, she all the time she falls asleep, and it's necessary to push her.
Right.
And, is it like that?
Uh-huh. But not, not. That's not. I don't think why. I never heard at home any stories of her actually being blind. I don't think that.
How separate are the two stories in distance and geography?
Well, these are completely different people, of course.
How far apart?
If this gentleman is Nootka, and I'm referring to Kwakiutl stories, and
some places
there
it's
is
about
enormous.
30 miles.
Yes, it's not very far.
30 miles.
Would there be anything to explain?
But the traditions are quite different.
Oh, yeah. And there's some places like around Cotsino. The people in Cotsino and Hattusit, they're not very far apart.
And there's still this difference.
Oh, yeah. But the closer you get, of course, the closer you get to where the West Coast people bump into the Quaggios people, the closer things start to be similar.
But she plays different part and different roles.
I don't know if it's borrowed. I think the people up north, they got stories. The people in Saanich, they got stories. We all seen wild people. Like people today, they don't believe those stories. They say that it's made up, you know. But I think that our people seen wild women and wild men, and I think the Quaggios people seen wild women and wild men, and I think the people that live in Saanich seen wild women and wild men. And the difference is, I guess, is just how they seen those people that's in the bush, what they call wild women, wild men, wild people.
And you have stories too that she steals children and make them blind. With pitch,
she's chewing spruce gum all the time. Pitch from spruce trees, chewing it. And she makes her lips smack, you know, she's chewing. That's why the lips like that. She's chewing, trying to make it sound delicious. And those little kids, they want it. So when she gets real close, she's going to give them a piece. Put it on their eyes, block their eyes and make them so they can't see where they're going. So if they jump out of her basket, they're not going to be able to run and tell what happened. So she put them in her basket, and then she runs away to her house.
And the Nootka have the same kind of mask with the cute called Kwekwe.
Kwekwe?
Yes, you have them.
Yeah.
Too, yes. Do you carve some of them?
I've never carved that mask. I'm going to carve one.
Oh, that will be fine. They're very... what's their name in Nootka?
We say Kwekwe.
Kwekwe.
They say in Quaggios, I think they say Kwekwe too. Down here they say Swaihwe.
Yes.
It's
yes,
different.
It's the same mask, but it does not look the same.
They got the same tongues hanging out?
Yes, and the protruding eyes, yes. But the Sonokoa can be male too. It's a people. Yes, it's mostly female, but they can be male. There is something else I wanted to ask you. When you carve like that, you make a drawing then. And what about the depth?
You're limited by the wood. And you're limited by good taste. When you're going down, you look at how a face is. The nose is the most pronounced. Well, the nose should stick out the most. The nose should be the highest up. You go down to the forehead, along. How far down you go before you level off is, I don't know how you can explain that. It's what I said,
you
feel taste.
It. You feel it.
You know when you should stop. I've got a mask in here. I'll go get it. This guy here, the way the eye is on this, the depth is almost nothing. I mean, right here there's very little depth in that mask.
Yes.
But it looks all right. That's the way I wanted it to be. Where other times you go very deep. I've gone deeper on the eyes of this woman in this tiny little face than I have on that. Look at the difference.
What does it represent?
Humanoid raven, half raven, half man.
Raven.
That's in the beginning of the world when we were equal with the animals. Start at the very bottom. Just make it rough. When you get it fairly rough, you figure out where your distance are. Then you can start carving things fine. I'm going to go back this way now. Finish this man's head.
So you'll stop here. Go back
there. And then
down.
Go back up there.
Uh-huh.
You move around. You work on something too long, you can get... it can get stale on you.
And when you make a copy of an old pole like this, do you feel sometime that you should or would like to do it differently?
Oh, very much. Very much. Very, very much. A terrific desire to change things.
And what do?
You struggle and you continue copying. If you look at something like... just something simple like... oh, the depth here. The depth of it, you go down in here. So there. See the depth here. See, I've gone have gone deeper on mine than on here. And the reason I did that is because this is all rough in here.
Yes.
And I have a feeling that when they did it, they wanted, maybe they didn't have the time, but they wanted it to be smooth. Yeah. And so I'm going to, I smoothed it out in here.
Mm-hmm. And are there other things that you'd like to do differently?
Design-wise?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Like what? When you have to transfer?
Well, for instance, with the height, like this lightning snake, I've been designing these guys, coming up with my own ideas, how I think they should be and how I grew up with it. And at home, the masks that we have and the designs that I've seen of that lightning snake, they've got plumes off the top of their head. They call it a feathered dragon. They got plumes coming off the top of the head. And that's the way I like it to be. So if I was to do this pole myself, I would put plumes on his head.
So do you expect that after you've done this one, you'll do another one that will be the one you would like to make?
Oh, I'm going to sometime, for sure. I would like very much to.
And what do you think the old people would say if they saw one that you made the way you feel it should be, and they would look at it, and what do you expect?
I think they'd be very pleased. Very pleased.
They wouldn't think that you have
betrayed
their...
No, no, like I said, where I'm from, all the designs I've seen as I've grown up with it have plumes on the head. This is from further north. This is from Friendly Cove, from Yukwat. They're another, you know, they're over 100 miles away from us.
And what happens when you see, say, a totem pole copied by another carver and that he has taken some freedom?
What happens when I see that?
Yes. What do you say?
It depends on what kind of freedom he's taken. I see people doing things like putting a lot of garish color on a pole. I don't like that. I see people taking the freedom of, rather than spending the time to carve detail, painting detail. Instead of carving it like it's supposed to be carved, they paint it.
Yes, I've seen it.
You don't see that art should tell all over again the same stories?
No. It's good to see people moving, you know. Otherwise, we'd just be imitating, you know. Spend the rest of our life imitating. We don't live the same as we did, you know, 200 years ago. And if we don't live the same, I don't think our art should be the same.
At the end of a potlatch, a chief would speak about his wealth, and often his copper would be on the floor before him. And he would stand holding his own staff, his own speaker staff, in hand. And it varied from family or individual to individual, but some men would hold the mask like this and speak, and then put it on the top of the forehead and speak some more, and this was all highly formalized, and then finally you would drop them on above the face and speak, you know, like that. And as I say, most of the masks that are about the size of a human face and very finely carved were used on those occasions, but the larger masks, such as that one, and the ones that are more crudely carved, represented the dancing Zuniqua, and frequently the dancer would wear a clam basket on their back, and there'd be a little puppet with a child of a Zuniqua peeking out of the basket.
And I can as well begin by telling you the story. This goes back to 1941 or 42, when I arrived in New York as a refugee and got the revelation of the Northwest Coast art in the Northwest Coast Gallery at the American Museum of Natural History. And I was so fascinated by this art, of which I knew very little, that I spent hours and hours in that gallery. And I was immediately, irritated or bothered with a certain type of mask, which I believe you call the Swaiwe mask, from the Salish Indians around Vancouver, because it looks so different from the rest. not the same shape, not the same style, and especially these protruding eyes. And my problem was, why these protruding eyes? What is the meaning? What are they for? But, well, I left the problem aside because I could not find anything in the literature which could help me a great deal to understand. And it is only years and years after, as a matter of fact, well, practically 30 years later, that after I had done so much work on the mythology and tried to have a new approach to the understanding of myth, an approach, may I remind you, which consists in, stating from the beginning that a myth, a given myth, has never a meaning in itself and by itself, but it is only in opposition to another myth that we can unravel the meaning. And just once I remembered my house spent at the American Museum and asked myself, well, is it not possible to apply the same kind of methodological approach to masks? Not, of course, only, also, but not only to the mythology surrounding the mask, but to the mask considered as art objects and looked at from the stylistic angle and the plastic form, the color, and so on. And then going back to the Swaiway mask, the question I put to myself was, I cannot understand the mask taken isolated as something apart. But is there somewhere nearby a mask which, from a stylistic point of view, could be considered as being the symmetric of the Swaiway mask, having all the same properties, but the other way around, if I may say so. And immediately, the Tsonokoa mask of the Kwakiut Indian, which are close neighbor to the Salish, that is, this mask, came to my attention. Why? Well, first of all, of course, there was the problem of the protruding eyes. And it is very striking that the Tsonokoa mask have not protruding eyes, but deep-set eyes. That is exactly the opposite. Not always, as a matter of fact, deep-set eyes, sometimes slit eyes, but which means, in both cases, because the mythological material is quite, and the ritual too is quite clear in this respect, that the Tsonokoa is either blind or sleepy, does not see well. And then it was possible that out of the opposition a meaning can be extracted. That is, if deep-set eyes or slit eyes means blindness, then perhaps protruding eyes would mean the opposite of blindness, that is, clear sight. This is not all. See, the Swaiway mask, well, of course, it is not white, but we know very well from the costume which the dancers were wearing that it was connected with white color, because the costume was entirely made up of white swan feather and swan down. While the Tsonokoa mask are mostly black, and connected with a black color, because the dancer wearing the Tsonokoe mask had a black cape or a bear, black bear fur. So we have here a new opposition between white and black. Even more so, it is striking that the white of the Swayue mask is entirely borrowed from the bird category, feather and dolls, while the black of the Tsunokoa mask is connected not with feather, but with hair. And you have the hair there. Here's two, and some of the masks which we know are quite hairy, completely. So we have here a new opposition in the animal kingdom between feather and hair. Now, the mouth, a striking point about the Swayue is this gaping mouth with the open jaws, while the mouth of the Tsunokoa can be described as having pursed lips, as a matter of fact, to explain that it cries, ooh, something of the kind, I don't know. The Swayue mask has as a fundamental character a hanging tongue, protruding and hanging. And in the Tsunokoa, there is also something hanging, which is not the tongue, but the breast, which are always a hanging breast, and this is very much emphasized in the literature. So the Swayue mask belongs essentially to the social world, while the Tsunokoa is an antisocial being. And even more, its main part in the mythology is kidnapping of children. That is, instead of bringing the ancestors to the lineage, taking away the descendant. We have here a very neat inverted relationship. As to the origin, I was saying a moment ago that in Salish mythology, the masks were fished in a lake, in the water of a lake. But not always, because we have inside a Salish mythology a very neat inverted relationship according to if the origin myth are from the mainland or from Vancouver Island. And in one case, they are fished out of the water. In the other case, they come down from the sky. But in both cases, they are connected with a vertical axis, either high or low, either sky or water. Now, what is the origin of the Tsunokoa mask? They come from the wilderness, from the woods, from the forest, and their connection is not with a vertical axis, but with an horizontal axis, not high or low, but far away. I was a moment ago saying that the protruding eyes of the Swayue could mean that they are clear-sighted. And at least among one Salish group, I must confess that I was not prepared to lecture, and I don't remember exactly which one, but perhaps Professor Hotholm will remind better. But it is said that during the Swayue dance, there is a clown figure with a spear and trying to blind the Swayue dancers. Why? So they are clear-sighted, and the dancer try to blind them. While for the Tsunokoa, it is just the opposite, because she is nearsighted or blind, but she tries to blind the children which she steals by putting pitch on their eyes. So in one case, it is a passive relationship to blindness. In the other case, it is an active relationship. And finally, among the Salish, I am told that the Swayue mask did appear on potlatches and lay feasts, but never during the winter ceremonial, while among the Kwakiutl, the Tsunokoa was a play part in the winter ceremonial, if I'm not mistaken, in a minor society, but nevertheless a society in its full right. Therefore, you see that we have a complete symmetry, not only on the plastic level, but also on the mythological level. And if I had time, I could also show that in the distribution of the corresponding myth, there is also a symmetry, because it's very striking that the axis of the distribution of Swaiwe mythology among the Kwakiut and the Salish is a vertical one. It goes north-south. It goes from Cape Scott to the Comox country. While when you look at the mythology, the tribes who have mostly the Tsunokoa myth, and also the place names in this marvelous publication by Boas on geographical names of the Kwakiut, the place name with Tsunokoa in it, then it is an horizontal east-west axis which goes from the west coast of Vancouver Island to the deepest part of Night Inlet, you see. And here too we have the symmetry. Then we have a perfect inverted symmetry between the Swaiwe of the Salish and the Tsunokoa of the Kwakiut. But this is not all of the story, since we know that the Kwakiut did borrow the Swaiwe from the Salish under the name of, well, I cannot pronounce Kwakiut, but Kwakwe or something like that. And you can see that if there is a full series of binary opposition between the Salish Swaiwe and the Kwakiut Tsunokoa, there is, on the contrary, a very close correspondence on the plastic and stylistic level between the Salish Swaiwe and the Kwakiut Kwekwe. We have the protruding eyes, we have the hanging tongue, and in the Nootka specimen, which I have seen in the museum a moment ago, we have also the bird-like figures. But at the Victoria Museum, I saw yesterday a very interesting Kwakiut Kwekwe mask with the birds showing quite well. And we find, too, the white color, not in the costume, but in the mask, and the opposition is striking between the white Kwekwe and the black Tsunokoa. There is a close parallelism between the sociological function of the Swaiwe among the Salish and the Tsunokoa among the Kwakiut. Now, what about the Kwekwe? We have two different sets of origin myths for the Kwekwe with the Kwakiut. Some of a legendary character, and which are almost certainly true, that it is through intermarriage with the Comox that they got the Swaiwe mask, which they copied as a Kwekwe mask. But also, quite in the opposite direction, another set of myth, of a purely mythical character, explaining that it was a man at Cape Scott, that is another tip of Vancouver Island, which was given the Kwekwe mask by the Red Cods. And it is said in the myth that the Red Cods gave the mask, but nothing else, that they did not bring any present. And the conclusion of the myth is that this is why we say that Red Cods are stingy. So here you see it is just the contrary. Now, Dr. Webster was telling me a moment ago that there was more to it, and that the Kwekwe dance among the Kwakiut had a clownish character, which put them also in strong opposition with the dignified character of the Swaiwe. And that money was distributed but thrown away, and that the children could scramble and try to fight together, am I right, Dr. Wetzel, to get the money, which looks as if it was a distribution of riches, a kind of a derision of the distribution of coppers and the like, turning also the Swaiwe motif upside down. And then, if all this was true, and I don't hope that it is absolutely true, because probably I've made many mistakes and I'm not quite through with the job, it needs correction, but this is a purely tentative, then we should read a very striking conclusion, which is that in the field of masque and the plastic arts, and borrowing and imitation between two neighboring tribes, when the message of the myth, so to speak, is maintained identical, as with the Salish Swaiwe and the Kwakul Donokoa, then the plastic form becomes inverted. And on the contrary, when the plastic form is kept unchanged, as with the Salish Swaiwe and the Kwakut Kwekwe, then it is the message of the myth which becomes inverted.
Well, it is here, by looking at the mythology of this part of the world, that you find the more clues, if I may say so, for an interpretation. Now, this can be interpreted in two different ways. You could imagine that, the mythology started here and spread everywhere in North and South America from this basic spot. Or else that a mythology which existed of its own right everywhere just happened here in this part of the world to, how would you say, coagulate.
All of a sudden,
on account of peculiar conditions. And what are these conditions? We already discussed it, and I told you that the answer is with the archaeologist and the paleolinguist, much more than with us. But nevertheless, we find that it is a kind of earthly paradise, and there is no reason why Indians 10,000 years ago, or even more, would not have the same feeling. And also there is the fact that it is, in relative isolation from the rest of the continent, because there is the coast, and then you have the mountains behind, and that a lot of things, migratory movements and the like, may have taken place in the open space back of the Rockies or the Cascades mountain, and that here it remains more quiet. Mm. See, after all, this is one of the parts of Americas where we are sure that there was a continuous human occupation for a very protracted period of time. So perhaps here it was a place where the structural process, let's say the process of crystallization, could go quietly, slowly, exactly as it is needed for a crystal to take shape. See. I think we know now that myths are extremely meaningful, and that there is nothing really bizarre, absurd in them. So the answer will be, when there is something which we don't understand, and mythology is something that we did not understand, well, what we should do is try to understand it. And to try to understand is the only justification, the real justification, we can give to any scientific undertaking. It's not certainly the practical consequence of science which makes science worthwhile. That would be rather the opposite. Science has made for us a world which is very unpleasant to live in,
and which will become more and more unpleasant. But nevertheless, I'm not at all among those who despise science, who think that scientific undertaking should be given up. Because the real, the basic justification is to try to understand. This is what makes structural analysis worthwhile and every other undertaking at understanding worthwhile.
Wow. Claude, what a hat.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, you guys can't see him here, but Steve, could you describe this hat that Claude's wearing?
The last time I've seen a hat like this out on the streets was with the fashion plate, U.S.-backed president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai. it's the last time I saw a hat like this, and I'm impressed. You know, it looked good on Hamid. It looks great on Claude. For those who are unfamiliar with Hamid Karzai, which, by the way, like, look him up. Very probably the best dressed world leader during the time. You know, he was like standing next to George Bush Jr. in all these pictures, where Bush Jr. looks like a kid wearing his dad's clothes, right. And you know, Karzai looks amazing. I don't think he was necessarily that good. I don't know a lot about the internals of Afghanistani politics, so I'll just back out of that one. But I don't think there's a lot of love for him now. But I don't think anyone would dream of criticizing the outfits. But the hat is it sort of rises from the sides of the head into a sort of flat blade in the middle. But it's like a low rise blade. It's not like a Roman centurion's fan or something like that, or those similarly shaped things that the people who blow the long trumpets in Tibetan monasteries wear. It's a concise, narrow sort of, it's like if you took a chiclet and then cut a seam on the bottom and rounded it out and stuck it on a Lego guy's head.
The first bit that pops out of the water when a submarine rises.
Yes. Yeah. The tower. And it's like it's made out of a short fur. So it looks warm and it creates a great silhouette. I think, you know, there's no call for us to really exploit such a thing here, but, should I ever move back to Toronto, I'm definitely wearing one all winter.
Or, you know, I always find it easier to try a new dress on vacation. You should probably give that a crack. You know, next time you leave town, just show up to the new place with that Harzai hat.
Yeah, well, in Palm Springs or something, that's actually hotter than it is here. just like sweat streaming down my face. You know, it looks a little aerodynamic. It looks cool. It's a cool look.
I bet you'd walk a lot faster with it and cool and therefore be cooler. Obviously, this was why Harzai was wearing it.
Yeah. I mean, Karzai was also wearing multiple robes and stuff. Really incredible color palette, I have to say. Like hints of saffron, purple, green, navy blue. It was really like people die to dress like this. So, I mean, I guess to be fair, in the context of geopolitics, many people did die so that he could dress like that. But or so that he could dress that way on the global stage. Maybe he was dressing that way before he was in power. But Just, you know, anyway, that's all we need to... I think we're done talking about Claude's hat. Unless you think that his hat would call forth an opposite hat as a cultural product.
Oh.
Structurally, like, there must be the inverse. Like, if that hat protrudes, indicating, you know, his intellectual character, his... And since it's rather tall, his, like, closeness, you know, to heaven, right? Then there's some sort of other hat that diminishes you, that makes you seem smaller.
I feel like the cowboy hat does that.
Because the brim is so wide.
Yeah, well, I guess it makes the silhouette quite larger. Perhaps just like the baseball hat, which seems to have an entirely different function than Claude's hat here.
You know, I'm going to go with the cowboy hat because I... Hear me out. I think the cowboy hat has an orientation of horizontality.
True.
And there's absolutely no shade provided by Claude's hat, for example.
Well, it shades the very top of the head.
Just the area directly under the hat. There's no brim to speak of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas, like, the idea is that with the cowboy hat is that you have no idea how far into the hat the head protrudes, right? Like, a very tall hat could have a man with a very long head inside it, or you could have a short head just protruding a little bit into the hat. But it's the brim that defines the relationship of the hat, right? So it's like a very wide brim that extends, sort of talks about the horizontality of, like, large planar existence and ambling about on large unbounded tracts of land, whereas the aerodynamic sort of fin hat is an urbanite vertical hat, signifying the intellect and not so much kinetic kinetic travel over like broad range, if that makes
true.
Sense.
I wonder how, you know, during his extensive travels, Claude keeps that hat on top of his head. I imagined like a hair clip or something clipped to the inside of the hat, and then the inside.
I bet there's blooper reels of it coming off.
Yeah, perhaps.
It's just left on the editing floor. No one at the National Film Board of Canada dares to show the August anthropologist losing his wig, so to speak.
Well, I'd like to commend Mr. Hamilton for standing up to the barrage of questions that Mr. Levi Strauss had for him here on the talking show tonight. It would be rather thrilling. I know it's not his way. He's a sculptor. But for him to interrogate Claude with equal vigor about that hat.
Yeah, or any of the other practices of Claude's, which, you know, I mean, listen, in my social science educational background, Claude Lévi-Strauss was revered as, like, the lord of structural anthropology. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a lot of pizzazz in his writing, and I appreciate his very thoroughgoing dialectical approach to everything, even when that doesn't necessarily seem to be borne out by the field work, which I think this is the best part of this thing, is watching him sort of ask questions where by he sort of asks to be told specific things in the question.
Right.
I think it's Mr. Hamilton's credit that sometimes he would just not play along.
Yeah, it was a bit like a photographer shooting a model. Could you turn this way just a touch? Could you?
Yeah. And what happens if the people don't like what you do? You know, he's like, well, it's their problem. They have bad taste.
Yeah.
No, Mr. Hamilton was very charming throughout. I thought it was really nice how both practical, also, you know, that ostensibly there are symbolic dimensions involved, but then, as I think And I think this is funny to bring to the, you know, Marx-influenced dialectical anthropologists table, but just that there are material conditions to producing a sculpture.
Yeah.
that are not necessarily bound entirely by ritual practice.
Or myth.
Or myth. Yeah, exactly. You know, sometimes it's just about how much saw can you get in between here and there, you know? Mm-hmm. It's how much room do you have to play with here before you're in like physical trouble, you know? Like it's good to sort of reflect on the material bases of some of the cultural practice as well. And also, I thought that part was also really charming.
Yeah, no, it's I guess that's a unique ability of the artist to be so so vague and so blunt at the same time.
Yeah, but I mean, also to be fair, at every point, Claude and friend were like, "Is this not what you people do?" And he was like, "No, we don't do that. That's the other guys." Which I think is also good to just stand up for the facts, you know, being like, yeah, well, I'm making this mask, but
yeah,
we don't think about that way.
Oh, don't get me wrong. We have the myth of the crazy woman too, but we just do a little different over here.
Yeah. No, she's not blind.
Yeah. Yeah. She just had, you know, sunken eye sockets.
Which is about creating a larger brow, not at all about the eye sockets itself. It's just, and then like, and obviously that has like a direct relationship on interacting with a physical material when you're trying to create a mask in the first place too, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Wow. No, it was a really nice, I think this has been a really lovely visit. Speaking of outfits too, Ron Hamilton. Wow.
Yeah. That's a quality, that's some quality garb.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic, headpiece. Really great, you know, cool frames.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, just all around, solid manner about him.
Yeah. A real pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, that about wraps it up for tonight, everyone. Thanks for joining us, Claude, plus one, Mr. Hamilton. Good morning, Chinatown.
The ghost of Hamid Karzai's hat waves goodbye.